Started.
All right. So last week we saw Nathan's prophecy to David, and we saw how this was the total inversion of the original prophecy Nathan had to David, right? Back in Parak Zion, when Nathan told him that the bad news was he was not going to build a Beis HaMikdash, but the good news was that his son would build a Beis HaMikdash. He would have a son who Hashem would love. Hashem would treat as a son. He would be given a royal dynasty that would last for all time. And the Nevuah year totally undid all of that, right? He's evil is going to come from inside his house. Hashem is going to kill his child. He's been rejected. And now the question is going to be, now that we have the response of Hashem, right, who's finally come flying back into the picture after David thought he was all gone. So what is David's response going to be, right? So if we just jump back into the Pesukim, so the Navi tells us, Nathan goes home, and then immediately after Nathan goes home, Vayigov Hashem esayelad asher yalda eshes uriya leDavid veyeyanash. And we can't help but notice the fact that the Navi really drives home for us what's going on over here, right? That it is the wife of Uriah who gave birth to this child. We're not calling her Bathsheba. We're not calling her Eshes David. Even if you think that she was married to Uriah, by now she definitely is not, right? Uriah is dead. So the Navi is going out of its way to editorialize here by calling Bathsheba Eshes Uriah. The Malbim jumps on top of this because remember the Malbim thinks that Uriah and Bathsheba were actually not married. So the fact that the Navi without question uses this line in a context when it is not literally true, because right here she is no longer married to Uriah. So the Malbim says, right, that first of all, that helps his whole argument throughout this whole story that, you know, it was Haisa Nira Be'ine Hashem. Ilu Haisa Ishto Kanal, right? As I've said before, it's Hashem considered it as if they were married. Whether or not that has ever been the case, technically, the Malbim says has not been the point. And that just feeds into, you know, some of the general approach we've had in analyzing this whole episode. The other point that the Malbim notes is that why is the Navi doing this, right? Why is the Navi emphasizing right now that it's Heshes Uriah? Because this is why this kid is doomed, right? It is specifically because it is the offspring of Eshes Uriah and David that can't work, right? Malbim says Mitzad sheyalda Eshes Uriah. It's because she was that the person who gave birth to this child was the wife of Uriah. You know, this is just not an offspring which can survive, which is only going to heighten the central question. Well, if the offspring can't survive, then how are things going to turn around? Because we know that Shlomo Malach is going to ultimately come from this, right? So the fact that we have this pasuk here driving home, there cannot be a, you know, successful produce from this union is only going to heighten the question down the road. How is that going to work? But for now, the Navi is making that very clear. Then we have David's response, and David's response is all around incredible. And we need to, you know, when we start to shift now, we talked about what exactly the Averas were in the literal level and maybe the level beyond that, the ethical level, and what that did to David. And we talked about Hashem's response and the Onesh and the punishment and the Mida Keneged Mida. Now the question is, what's David's response, right? And there's tshuva, but you can really break down tshuva into three pieces. And the Navi is only going to talk about two of them, and it's the two that we don't really talk about very much when we talk about tshuva. When we talk about tshuva, we normally think about regret, you know, the feeling bad about it, all the emotional turmoil and guilt, and we, you know, clap al chet, and we dab, and we cry, say we're not going to do this ever again. And that's a piece of tshuva, but it's really interesting and probably really important that the Navi does not put that front and center in Sefer Shmuel at all. It'll be all over Sefer Tehillim, so we'll look at that in a couple of weeks, but that is not the element of tshuva that the Navi wants us to really focus on. Because the truth is, probably, in many ways, it's the easiest part of tshuva. It's not difficult to feel bad about sinning. I mean, everyone feels bad about sinning. You know, it can be hard to feel as bad as you need to. It can be hard to acknowledge that you did wrong and stop deluding yourself. That's only one stage, right? The other two stages of tshuva, and those are the ones that the Navi is really going to put front and center for David. Number one is trying to actually undo what you've done. You know, not just feel bad about it, but to actually, to the best of your ability, try to undo it. Now, David is limited to how much he can do about that because Uriah is dead, but we'll see what he can do to undo the impact of the Aveira. And the third piece, which the Navi is also going to focus on, is accepting the consequences of the Aveira, taking responsibility, right? So there's trying to undo what you've done as much as you can, and there is taking responsibility for what you've done, be that in dealing with the consequences of the sin, be that in dealing with the punishment which comes as a result. And in those areas, David is going to excel, and that seems to be exactly what the Navi wants us to focus on when thinking about how one responds to sin. The regret, that we'll get to in Sefer Tehillim. The other things, which really are harder, the actual building back from the destruction of Chet, which David is going to begin to do over here. So how do we see David trying to undo what he does? Well, so we have Pasuk Tes Zayin. Let's read it carefully. It's a bit of a cryptic pasuk, but there's a lot going on over here. Navi says, "Vayvakesh David es Elokim." Okay, so David seeks out God, ba'ad hanar, for the child. Vayatzam David tzom. David fasts. Uba, he comes the lun, and he lies down. Vishachav arza, and he sleeps on the ground. That's a very strange pasuk, right? We know how one would normally talk about davening. Davening, vayispalel David, vayetar David would be words that we could use. Vayvakesh David es Elokim. To seek is almost never used in the language of davening. If you look at the Targum Yonasan, the Targum Yonasan, he translates it, right? Ba David rachamim min kadam Hashem. He sought mercy. It's davening. That's not what the word actually was, though, right? The word literally just was, David seeks God. He seeks God, and he fasts, and then he comes, he dwells, and he sleeps on the ground. Also, very cryptic. Why not just say he sleeps on the ground? What's bavalan? What does it mean he's coming? What does it mean he's sleeping? So we need to figure out what's happening in that passage. Let's just look at the end of what's going to happen. This part, we don't need to look at inside in depth, but just, you know, we know how the story is going to go. So the Ziknei Beiso, David's, the people in the house, want David to get up, and he ignores them. He won't eat any food. Lo ava v'lo bara itam lachem. He wouldn't eat any food, right? Sudas havra'a is the meal a mourner has after they get up from, or after they stop aninus and begin sitting shiva. I think it's the Malbim who says that it means to even eat the tiniest amount of food. David won't eat anything. And then after 7 days, right, David's avadim are afraid of telling him that the child has died because they make a kal vachomer. If he's been reacting so dramatically, lying in the dirt and not eating for a week, what's he going to do after the child actually dies? And then David finds out what happens, and we'll see his reaction. So what exactly is David doing? What is happening with lo bavalan v'shachavarz? All the Mefarshim give basically the same answer. Rashi's the first one to have it. I just put the Radak on the source sheet because he has it most clearly in terms of explicating the pasuk. So we'll see what's happening, and then we have to unpack it. So the Malbim explains, the Radak explains, Bavalan, he came and he dwelt. What does it mean? Ba mi beis Hashem. It means, the pasuk is telling us in shorthand, he came from the Mishkan. He has been in the Mishkan. Why? Shahay Hashem. Kol Hayom, Sam Umis Balel. He spends all day fasting and davening in the Mishkan. Remember, the Aron has been brought into Yerushalayim, but there's no Beis Hamikdash yet, so it's just a tent with the Aron in it. So that's where David is spending all day long. And then he's not going to sleep. He can't sleep in the Mishkan, you know. So Ukshaba Labeso Lun Below Achila B'Shachav Arza. And then when he came home, he refused to eat in the palace. And he slept on the floor. So that is the image. That is what we have with David. David is seeking Hashem. He is going to the Mishkan. That's where he's spending all day long. And then at night, he goes back to the palace, but he doesn't eat any food. He just sleeps on the floor. So we can't help but notice, I think, that David is exactly here undoing some of the major original things he did wrong at the beginning of the story, right? Beginning of the parak, we found David in his palace on his bed, right? But Yaakov David me'al mishkavo be'salich agag be'samala. So he's in his bed, he's in his palace, he's on the roof of his palace. And now we have the exact opposite, right? He now is on the floor. He's not going to bed. Instead of lying on his bed, he's lying on the floor. He's not up on his roof. He's on the floor. Moreover, David in Perek Yud Aleph, we said really David's greatest betrayal was what? That line he had to Yoav after the battle report, where he said, the world is random, world is governed by chance, and you know, some people are gonna die in battle, and that's just how life works. Which was an absolutely shocking thing for David of all people to say, because oops, there goes the microphone. For David of all people to just deny divine providence, right? And imagine that Hashem is not involved in the world or in the story, and Hashem's name doesn't appear in the whole parak. That was David's greatest self-betrayal. So what's the first thing David does now? He doesn't just daven, but vayvakesh David es Elokim. He is actively seeking God's presence back. Right, he has chased Hashem out of his life in Perek Yud Aleph. He's trying to bring Hashem back. He had sinned in the palace, enjoying the luxuries of being king and everything that comes with it. And now he's trying to undo that as well. Don Micker points out as well that there's a certain irony here in that which person does David resemble when he's lying on the floor of the palace, refusing the food which is being offered by the palace officials? That was exactly what Uriah did in Perek Yud Aleph. When David sends the catered meal and he tells Uriah, here's a catered meal. Why don't you go home and eat with your wife in luxury? And instead, Uriah says, no thanks. And instead, he sleeps on the floor, right? And Navi told us before, David said, here's the Masas HaMelech. Why don't you go back home? Instead, Uriah does not eat the food. And Vayishkav Uriah Pesach Pesa Melech. Uriah sleeps by the doorway. Now, we talked back then about how there was an element of insubordination there. David, Uriah is picking that spot in a flagrantly public manner. But at the same time, you know, we have this reversal here where David, in the course of his tshuva, is trying to take on, is ironically maybe, adopting some of the behavior of Uriah. Okay. Now, one thing we should note, I guess, before we see the next couple of psukim, is it's clear, it's astonishing, really, the level of dedication that David has to this child. I mean, right, it's kind of astonishing and extreme. And we'll see what Chazal say about this in a minute, which we have to see a pasuk coming down the road. But the Rav Meidan in his book, I thought, has a very good point, which we should consider about what David's perspective was. We need to ask, and this is going to help us understand how David, you know, try to understand some of what David was doing. Why was David so desperate to cover up what happened with Bathsheba? We saw, right? The main problem was not the original sin itself. The main problem was the cover up, right? I mean, what Nasan blasts David for doing was killing Uriah and then bringing Bathsheba back into the palace afterwards. It was the cover up that was worse than the crime. But what motivated David to do that? So straightforward understanding is that it was embarrassment. You know, David just did not want his sin to be discovered. Now, there are all sorts of reasons why one could wonder about that. You know, for example, you have to wonder if Yoav is not a little bit curious about what exactly is happening with Bathsheba and Uriah after that letter ordering Uriah to be killed. And then David marries Bathsheba. If the number one priority was covering up, you know, his own embarrassment, this may not have been the best way to do it. Rav Meidan wonders, why couldn't they just have kept it all quiet, you know, just hush-hush. You try to have Uriah cover it up, but once that doesn't work out, so okay. So Bathsheba will have the child out of wedlock, and we can arrange something behind the scenes. You know, the bad news is that Bathsheba and Uriah, you may not be able to stay married anymore because of adultery. But the good news is that I'll, you know, give Uriah, you know, you want the greatest vacation home in the country, and anything else, you know, I'll give you your heart's desire. Just don't say anything about what's happened. You know, and Bathsheba will have had a child. Okay, adultery happens. You know, so he makes the suggestion that what is motivating David so desperately, and I think it's just worth considering, is David's care, not for himself, but his care for the child. Because we see both over here, David's three points, really, I think we should make. This is not from him, but number one, we see David's concern over here. Not just concern, but David's totally consuming dedication to this child. Number two, we're going to see David behave the same way for Avshalom later on in the story. And number three, if we go back to Nathan's prophecy yesterday, so the way that I suggested we should read Nathan's prophecy, remember that Nathan at the very end says that your son, this baby is going to die. So if you read the psukim, if you read the psukim straight, it seems like David cut Nathan off in the middle. Remember, David like interrupted. And Nathan is in the middle of going on. He's up there. He's giving the nevuah. Ko amar Hashem. Da, 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 da. And David just interrupted and said, Chatasi Hashem. You know, I can't take this anymore. I admit that I sinned. But Nathan, if that's true, was building up the punishments from smaller to greater. In which case, it's kind of remarkable that, you know, the peak and the crescendo of the punishments that Nathan tells David is coming is not that the sword will never leave your house. It is not that somebody will come and will rape your wives in full view of the public, right? The climax of everything is when Nathan tells David, Hagam habein hayilod l'cha yamos yumas. That is the last line. That David, Nathan says that, that's the mic drop line, right? That's no pun intended. That's when he walks out the door. That was the last, that's the most devastating line to David. Well, that makes a lot of sense if David has been trying desperately this whole time, not necessarily to protect himself, but trying to protect the child, which he feels responsibility for. So first he tries to protect the child from the stigma of Mamzeros by bringing Uriah and Bathsheba back together. Abarbanel didn't like that. Abarbanel said, you know, it's David is shirking his paternity of the kid. But on the other hand, no one's going to think that the kid is a mamzer if they think that Uriah is a child. And then once that doesn't happen, so now he needs to find some other way to save the kid. So we'll save the kid by getting Uriah killed, by bringing Bathsheba into the house. So if we think of that as what's been desperately motivating David this whole time, I think that can explain a few different things. It can explain, it fits David's general personality when it comes to his children, the personality profile of David as a father, someone obsessed with defending his kids, even when maybe he shouldn't be, as will definitely happen with Avshalom. It overlaps with the only real emotional outburst we see over here. We do not see love that David has for Bathsheba. And truth is, talk about David's embarrassment. I mean, David is really as self-confident a person as they come. Can you think of a more confident person? You know, so anyone who has fewer self-esteem issues than David HaMelech from what we've seen from beginning to end. You know, he does not seem like somebody. You know, when he's going to get cursed out in public by Shimei ben Gera when he runs away from Avshalom, his men will be horrified. He's not going to bat an eyelash. He's not going to care. You know, so on the other hand, though, you know, if we think that he's desperately trying to protect this kid, that can, I think, help put some of what's happening here in perspective. Right now, it doesn't work. You know, the child is going to die. But as we've seen in the course of David's davening for the kid, he has already made major strides in turning himself around. And then what happens is there's something that totally shocks his servants. So after they tell him and they made the Kavachomer, this is going to be such a disaster. If we react so badly, when the kid was alive. What's going to do after Hashem has killed the child? But nonetheless, Vayakum Davim in Haaretz, he gets up, Vayirchatz, Vayasach, he washes, he anoints himself, he changes his clothing. Vayavo Beis Hashem, he goes back to the Mishkan, Vayishtachu, he bows down, he goes to the palace, and he asks for some bread. The Avadim do not understand what on earth is happening. And the line that David has is one of the quintessential lines of Kabbalah Sadin. We'll see what Chazal do with this. He says, "Ode yalad chai tzanti vevke ki amarti miodeya v'chanini Hashem v'chai yalad." I wept and I fasted because I said, "Who knows? Maybe Hashem will be gracious to me and he will save the kid." Let's also remember, by the way, David's avadim do not know about Nasan's prophecy. They have no way of knowing, and that makes David's week of davening even more amazing. You know, it's one thing they thought. Okay, babies get sick, especially back then. David was davening for his infant. They had no clue that David had been told by God, "Your child will die." So they don't even realize how wild this line is, because David was told that the kid was going to die, and nonetheless, he davens. I can still have hope. Maybe Hashem will be gracious and he'll save the kid. Then what happens afterwards? After David pulls out all the stops, he does not leave any stone unturned. But after Hashem has given the judgment, he accepts it. Atames, lamazani tzamu chala shivo od. Can I bring him back? Ani holeichelam v'lohu yashov elai. I'm going to him. This is one of the, you know, instances we've had a couple in Sefer Shmuel. Here's one where the Navi gives, you know, tips its hat to the ideal of Olhava. He's not going to come back to me. So David tries as hard as he possibly can before the din, but once the din has happened, he accepts it in really the most unbelievable way possible. So the Gemara, it's clear that this is. The Gemara is picking up on this in the beginning of Brachos. Gemara quotes a conversation between Chizkiyo and Yeshaya, who I think are first cousins, Gemara says. When Yeshaya tells Chizkiyo that he's going to die. Chizkiyo is sick. Yeshaya tells him that he's going to die. Chazal fill in the whole back and forth. They explain that Chizkiyo is being punished because he would not try to have children. Chizkiyo says, "I tried for a good reason. I know through Ruach HaKodesh that I'm going to have a son who's going to be a disaster." Yeshaya says, "Well, that's not your problem. You know, you have to do your mitzvot and to let Hashem take care of the rest." So Gemara says that Chizkiyo tries to fix the problem. So Chizkiyo says to Yeshaya, he says, "Ashtahali bartach. Okay, so I'll marry your daughter. After the garma zechuscha didi didach. Maybe, you know, our combined merits will help save it." So the Gemara says, Amrulai, Yeshaya says to Chizkiyo, "For nigzra lecha gzera." No, it's too late. We can't fix it. It has been determined. You are going to die. And then Chazal say, what does Chizkiyo say? In the Navi, what happens? In the Pesukim, we just have Yeshaya give his message. Yeshaya leaves and Chizkiyo davens. But Chazal put something in here. And we got to figure out where it comes from. So Chazal say that Chizkiyo says back to Yeshaya, "Amrulai ben amots kalei nevoas chavitzei. Stop prophesying and get out of here." He doesn't say Yeshaya, he says Ben Amos. "Kach mitublani mibeis aviyaba. I have a tradition from the house of my grandfather or great-grandfather or maybe great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Afilu cherev chad menachas al tzavar shaladim. Even if a person has a sword on his neck, al yimna atzam in harachim. He should never give up hope for mercy." And the Gemara quotes Rabbi Yochanan is saying the same thing. The Pasuk and Iyov, "Kein yikdaleni. Lo ayachel, even if God would kill me, I still would trust in him." Now, I think it's obvious that where is this Mesorah coming from, that the from Beis Avi Abba that Chizkiyo has? What is the previous example we've had in the house of David where the Navi comes, gives the message of death, and the Melech says to the Navi, "That's very nice, but I'm still going to daven as much as I can." It's clear the Chazal are seeing a connection between what's happening with Chizkiyo and what is happening with David HaMelech, right? And if that's the case, so we talk about David's major betrayal being the view right? That the world is governed by chance. So Hashem, that David has, you know, come all the way back into the most radical expression of bitachon imaginable, right? He's been told that the son is going to die. He's gotten the nevuah, and nonetheless, hein yikdaleni lo ayachel. As bad as it is going to get, I never give up hope that Hashem can come in and save the day. Now, what's even more amazing, you know, just to think about this Gemara for a second, just what Chazal are seeing in here, is that ultimately, what was the response to David? You know, the response to David was a negative, right? He was refused. And even though David was refused, the Gemara says that Chizkiyo still has a Mesora, Mikublani Mibes Aviyaba, right? The answer might not be yes. The Mesora is not, if you daven as hard as you can, Hashem will change his mind. The Mesora was, you daven as hard as you can, and Hashem might change his mind. And the fact that that did not happen for David did not in any way alter the message which is given on to his descendants, right? It's just like, it's an amazing, amazing Gemara. So that really, you know, helps us think about the transition and transformation in David's spiritual perspective. We do need to ask a glaring question, which the Mefarshim all deal with here in the Pesukim. The Radak has the most extensive discussion of it. We'll go through it quickly, which is David behaves like an Avel while the child is alive, and then he stops behaving like an Avel after the child dies. Right? What is he doing? You know, you're supposed to get up from Shiva. So why is David getting up after the kid dies? Right? Everything is backwards. Radak has two main explanations. I think there's a lot. The first one, he suggests, is that, well, if you just read this very narrowly, very technically, you know, David does not become a halachic avel until after the child is buried. So until then, he's in state of aninus, but he's not an avel. So he says maybe that's what's happening with David. David does all of this immediately after the child dies, before he's even buried. Before he's buried, the first reaction David has is he goes, you know, well, why does he have to? He goes to the Mishkan, he bows down to Hashem, he accepts what happens, he's mevarech al hara, right? One has to bless Hashem and accept the bad, just like the good, but it's not just saying the words of Baruch Tayin Emes. In David's case, he actually means it when he says Baruch Tayin Emes and he goes to the Mishkan. That's one approach. The second approach, though, which I think really is the more compelling one, is that there was no need to mourn this child at all. Why was that? So the way the Radak says it is that the kid was a nephel. It's possible that the child was never going to be viable. Now, Radak suggests that that's because, you know, back in the time of Chazal beforehand, if the child would be born at 8 months, the child would not be assumed viable. And if the child dies before 30 days, the kid, you don't mourn for the kid. So Radak suggests that's what's happening. He points out there's a difficulty here at the end of the piece. Sorry, but you know, that's what he says over here. And the end says that's a bit of a problem because David and Bathsheba have only been together once. So David knows exactly when this kid was conceived. So there is a difficulty there in saying the kid was a nephel in terms of how old he was when he was born. But I think the pshat probably is very similar to that, that even though he wasn't, you know, a biological nephel, he was a nephel. Why? Because Hashem told him this is not going to be a viable child. You know, Rav Medan points out that the kid dies after 7 days. Why? What's the significance of after 7 days? He dies a day before the bris milah. You know, he dies one day before he would be accepted into Hashem's covenant. It sounds from the pesukim like the day. It sounds like it's the day that the baby is born that immediately Nasan comes to David and says, "You should know this child who has just been born will not live." So I think it makes a lot of sense to explain that that means he's an aphel. You don't mourn the child because immediately after being born, David has been informed that this kid is not viable and he does not make it to the age of 8 days. He does not make it to the age of bris milah. So that's how we can understand what's happening exactly with the avelus. Now let's look at a couple more psukim, which is really going to 95% of the way bring things to full circle in terms of David's tshuva here in Sefer Shmuel. So just two psukim. Vayinachem David eis ba'sheva ishto, So David comforts Bathsheba. So they go there together. They have a child. Yikra or Vatikra. It's a Kri and a Ksiv, whether it's he called or she called. Eshemo Shlomo. Vashem Aivo. So they have a baby. The name of the baby Shlomo. Hashem loves the baby. Ba'avur Hashem. And Hashem says that the baby should also have the name of Yedidya, friend of God. Okay, so let's just unpack how in these couple of psukim, we once again see an undoing of what has happened before and a restoration of the world pre the Avera of David and Bathsheba. It's impossible to miss the connections between this liaison between David and Bathsheba over here and the original one, except how everything is opposite from the first time around, right? The first time, I should have really put these together in a box, but the first time that David is with Bathsheba, it was by Yishlach David, he sends, right? Yishlach David Malachim, by Yikacha, right? He sends messengers and they take her. It sounds like there was an element of coercion there, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. What is it this time? It's not sending people and it's not taking. It's Vayinachem, right? He goes by himself and he is comforting her for the loss of her child. We also talked a couple weeks ago, right? Bathsheba is also mourning the loss of this child. And David is coming in not to take, not for purposes of pleasure. He's coming in primarily for the purpose of emotional comfort. You know, even the word linachim is always the word of transition. You know, we translate it as comfort. When we talk about, you know, vayinachim Hashem ha-ra'a, it means a change of mind, right? There is a transformation. But that's why, you know, a comfort is, you know, going from sad to happy. So everything here is being turned around. So number one, we have what's happening before, right? And also, the two are linked. I checked. It's the only two times we have in Tanakh where you have a man and woman who are together sexually, and you have vayavo ela vayeshkavima. He came to her, and they lay together. You have that vayavo ela vayeshkavima, and we have that in Pasuk Dal and Perek Yud Aleph, vatavo elav vayeshkav ima. Right. So there, it's the two times that we see them together, but everything around it is totally different. Last time she was, of course, Bathsheba Eshes Uriachiti. Now is the second time. She has not been mentioned by name until now. Remember? She's only been called Eshes Uriah. This is now the second time that she's called Bathsheba, but she is Bathsheba Ishto, right? This time she's David's wife. And what happens at the end, right? Instead of her going home and then sending the message that she's pregnant, we have the child. The pregnancy is not a disaster which has to be dealt with, but rather the pregnancy is a bracha. And I think it's really interesting that it's both a kri and a ksiv of vayikra or vatikra. What does that mean? Seems to be just a pshat, is that both of them independently came to the same name. David decided the kid's name should be Shlomo, and Bathsheba thought that the kid's name should be Shlomo, right? That's why it's not Vayikru'u, they named him Shlomo, and it's not either one of them. David thought this was the appropriate name, Bathsheba thought that this was the appropriate name. So they're aligned here, you know, they're together, they're aligned in their thinking, rather than her going back home and then being separated and then going back through messengers. Then what happens with the kid? Over here, right? Instead of the son who is not able to even make it to 8 days, right? The kid who was born, essentially, as we said, the kid was born not viable. He had an unviable child. Here you have the complete child. You have the child who is Shlomo, right? He is Shalem. There's Shalom here. There's peace. There's a closing of the circle. We are healing the breach that we had in the last two brackets. And Nasan comes back a third time. And this is absolutely critical. Because we said last week that when Nasan came to David with the prophecy of punishment, that prophecy was essentially undoing everything that had been promised in prophecy number one. But what happens over here is the restoration of all of that. What had Nasan promised David originally in Perek Zion? You're going to have a child, right? I'm going to love the kid. He's going to be like a son to me. I'm going to approve of him. And, right, Neman beis chama machta arola. Now, what happens over here? That child is born, right? Nasan had told David in Perek Zion, your son will build the Beis HaMikdash. Hu yivna bayis lishmi. And now that's exactly what we have. We have the restoration of that original levuah with the third time that Nasan is coming and the birth of Shlomo. So we think about some of the major betrayals that David had done to himself and how by this point they've been healed, right? In terms of his own relationship with Hashem, we've discussed. You know, we talked about David's failure to listen to the rebuke of Uriah. Well, now we see the degree to which he has absorbed the rebuke of Nasan, right? We talked about the breach he had made between husband and wife, and now he can't repair the breach between Uriah and Bathsheba, but he is repairing the breach of husband and wife, and that he and Bathsheba are coming back together, right? And it's also important, I think, to think about David's accepting the responsibility over here. You know, we'll see in a couple weeks, when David talks about his sin being in front of his eyes at all times, that's going to be embodied by Bathsheba. Looking at Bathsheba is brutal for David, but he takes responsibility for the Aveira, right? And he's now going to bring Bathsheba into the house. I forget who makes this point, but he's created a widow and he's going to take care of Bathsheba. He's going to take care of the child, and it's an act of chesed, which Hashem appreciates, right? We had this massive breach, and now we have unity. Now I think there's just one more piece. You know, in some ways, the story ends over here, and this is there's a petucha, but I think the next couple of lines in the parak are also a kind of continuation. Right? In one way, this is the end, but there's like a related couple of psukim. So last couple of psukim of the parak, you know, our parak, go back to the war, right? Let's remember in Divrei Hayamim, this whole story was wiped out. It was erased, and we just had the whole straight war narrative. So here, the Navi now goes back to the war, but I think that we still need to be thinking about what's happening with David and Bathsheba, because there's one more major piece for David to repair. Yoav is fighting. Yoav conquers the Ir HaMelucha. He took the palace complex. He tells David, I took the water system from the city. You know, now we need to make a big push to conquer the rest of the city. So Yoav, really interestingly, seems to still have total respect for David, despite what happened in the previous parak. So he says, now come, lest I get the honor. What do we have in parak haftes? In pasuk haftes, v'yasov David as kol ha'am, v'yelech rabasa v'yelecham ba v'yelechtah. David goes and he takes the whole army with him to Rabbah Pnei Ammon. He conquers the city. He takes the spoils. Divrei Hayam tells us he donates much of it to Hekdesh. And then we're told at the end, by Yashav David v'chol ha'am Yerushalayim. David goes back with everyone else to Yerushalayim. Well, the Malbim had told us that this whole problem began with David staying home and sending everyone else to the to fight instead. Right? And he had failed to follow up on what we had in Perek Yud, that glorious moment when David gathered the whole army and everyone was together and they united and they defeated Aram in the north. So now David repairs that as well, right? He is just methodically undoing each of the mistakes he has made in the last couple of prakim. And the last mistake that he undoes is the one which in some ways, you know, many ways really, is the least severe, but it also was the one that unlocked everything else. Now he's reassuming his responsibility as king. He's reassuming the responsibilities of the leader. He's going out. He's going to fight. He's going to lead the people. And then he brings all of them back together to Yerushalayim, right? So David and the Am are united. The story began with David and Yerushalayim, divided from his people who are outside. The parak ends with everyone coming back to Yerushalayim together. I think, there's more to say about David and Bathsheba. I'll leave with a couple of thoughts and then we'll close. One, you know, think about this in your own, but the parallels between David and Bathsheba and Yehuda and Tamar are pretty overwhelming. There are many in the text, but just the general structure of a sexual liaison, which was, under questionable circumstances, the death of children, but at the end of the day, the acceptance of responsibility, and the story concluding with the birth of a child who is, going to be like the source of the geula. We have with both David and Yehuda, like the two major stories of tshuva in Tanakh, Yehuda and David. So, a lot to think of over there. And one other point, which I don't have anything on the source sheet, so I kind of forgot how ours are going, but I think it's just important for us to think about, is coming up in a couple of weeks, right? We're going to get to Parsha Shmini. So we're going to have David's, we're going to have Aaron's reaction to the loss of Nadav and Aviv. So we talking about David, David's accepting responsibility and the consequence of what he has to do, that there's the Tamar piece. But talking about the Kabbalah Sadin element for a minute, right? Accepting the punishment as was, and the way David does that really in an amazing fashion. So last week, I think at the end, we talked about the parallel between the Nevuah that Nathan had to David of the destruction of his house, and the Nevuah we had way back in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, when Eli was told about the destruction of his house. And they were totally parallel. I did so much for you. I gave the Kohanim so much. I gave, the royal house so much. How could you do this to me? And as a consequence, you're going to lose all of it. And we said then that Eli's reaction was the mistaken application of Aaron going. When Aaron reacts to the loss of his two sons, and by Edom Aaron, he accepts the punishment. He does not complain. So Eli did the same thing. Eli was quiet. We said the problem was that Eli accepted the punishment before it happened. What David does, and we think about, Aaron and David are the two people who sin terribly. They're punished terribly. And yet their houses survive afterwards for all time. It's really interesting. The Torah does not focus on Aaron's tshuva at all. I mean, there are hints to it, which Rashi picks up on. What the Torah wants us to know about Aaron is the accepting the din after it happens. David gives us the roadmap on both fronts. Before the punishment happens, as we saw, right? I'll have faith. I'll daven the utmost, and I'll try as hard as I can to undo what happened. Eli has his kids who are in the Mishkan doing everything that the Navi is complaining about, and Eli doesn't stop it, right? He says, okay, I accept what's going to happen. Don't accept what's going to happen. You try as hard as you can to undo the sin, right? Aaron will spend his whole life after leading Bnei Yisrael to the Egel Azav, he'll then spend the rest of his life leading the people to proper avodah in the Mishnah, right? He will be the source. You want to know how to serve Hashem, how to bring karbanos? Aaron is going to be the one who's going to tell you that for the rest of his life. It's the rest of his life, undoing the sin that he's had. And it's along with the undoing that you accept the consequences. But just accepting the consequences without trying to undo, that is just half the battle. And that's the difference between David and Eli. So we think about David's, what's the road to recovery when you've given the prophecy of destruction? Tshuva is unlimited. But we have to understand what that means. It doesn't mean that the power of tshuva is unlimited, and that it means you can always have a get out of jail free card. No, not at all. Right, David, we're going to spend the rest of the sefer seeing the punishments David is going to absorb for what he's done. But the message of tshuva we have, I think, both from Aaron Cohen and from David, on the one hand, sin gives us responsibility, which is to try to undo that, right, as much as we can do. There are going to be consequences in terms of punishment, which we need to accept. And if we can fulfill those two conditions, then there is the promise, right? That's where the rachamim comes into the story, that Hashem ultimately can, there can be hope, there can be a future. No one's getting off scot-free, and the sins that David has had in the last parish, he's going to have to pay for, and pay for it terribly. And tshuva doesn't mean you just get away with whatever you want, right? It means that if you accept responsibility, that ultimately Hashem can give a second chance in a way as well. I think that's the message. That's the piece. You know, Shaul, he blew it in terms of just not recognizing he had done anything wrong. Eli blows it in terms of only accepting the din, but not actually caring to undo it. And the tshuva of David, why the Navi wants us to see it so front and center, the reason why it's such an essential lesson, is because you really have the whole package. And that is what allows, despite the severity of his averus, which we said the Navi is going out of its way to try to drive home how bad it was, and how could this work? How could there be a future? Well, if you do what you're supposed to do afterwards, right, there always is hope for something ultimately. So next time we'll see the last piece, which is David's own emotional reaction. But you know, I think there's a lot to observe. And if there's any thoughts left to hear them, but that's for now I'll pause. Okay.